Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses in the government and commercial or corporate marketplace. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center, and in particular, it's after the impact program goes beyond awareness campaigns and state-of-the-art imaging to help veterans, first responders, and athletes. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. And finally, we want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And now, let's go to our program. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio Robert Cetino, National World War II Museum's Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of War and Democracy and the Samuel Zamuri Stone Senior Historian. And Robert, you said I only had to say that once.
No, look, you only have to say that once. A lot of people have a name tag. I wear a name placard. I have the two longest titles in the world. But the real short version there, Jim, is that I'm the senior historian at the National World War II Museum.
Well, we're thrilled to have you on. You are an award-winning military historian and scholar. You've published over 10 books on various and numerous articles on World War II and the 20th century military history. Folks may have seen you on the History Channel. You've been involved with the Department of Army Historical Advisory Subcommittee, and you have a long academic career. But you're here today to talk about the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, which I think just celebrated its 20th anniversary, didn't it?
Indeed. June 6th, 2020 was our 20th anniversary. The museum was an idea in 1990, but a couple of professors at the University of New Orleans, Nick Mueller and Stephen Ambrose, the two of them then took just about 10 years of fundraising to open the doors in 2020. And I think that might be the first lesson for anyone out there wanting to open up their own museum. Think about raising the money first, because, you know, you want to do a first-class job when you have an important topic.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned Stephen Ambrose, who many would know that was a prolific writer and of historical and fiction and factual books. I'm not sure they'd know he was a professor at the University of New Orleans, but he should get some credit for that.
He turned out many, many, many students in those years, and they remember him fondly, and many of them went on to their own careers as scholars and writers as well. Stephen Ambrose was a first-class intellect and a great writer. His pal at University of New Orleans, Nick Mueller, perhaps not as well-known as Stephen, who's, you know, one of the best-known authors in the history of the American historical profession, but Nick Mueller proved to be the organizational and fundraising genius, and together these two buddies at University of New Orleans put together this world-class facility down here.
So tell us what the mission of the National World War II Museum in New Orleans is.
Sure. You know, the mission of the museum, and every good cultural institution has a mission statement. You know, it's pored over and trimmed and vetted and edited. And ours is to tell the American experience in World War II. Why it was fought, how it was won, and what it means today. And then, you know, we go on and say, because we want to inspire contemporary generations with, you know, the price of freedom, just what it means to be a free people and the price that has to be paid. But I would highlight a couple of things in that mission statement. Jim, I think, first of all, the American experience. We make no bones about it. We're an American museum. We emphasize the American role in World War II. We think Americans need to know about the role that the country played and the price that individual Americans, over 400,000, paid in World War II, which is, of course, to pay with their lives. So the American experience, and then, you know, how it was, why it was fought. First of all, where did this war come from? Worst war in human history. It didn't just pop out of nowhere. It had a context. It had a backdrop. And that backdrop, of course, was the rise of dictatorships abroad, Hitler in Germany, the militarists in Japan, Mussolini in Italy. How it was won, because that's of course, the meat of the museum is, so why the war was fought? Okay, then how do you win a war, a global war of this scale? How do you come to grips with German military power in Europe and simultaneously fight a war against the Japanese in the Pacific? So we talk a great deal about that. And we have one more permanent exhibit still unbuilt, but being built, the Liberation Pavilion. And that's going to tell our visitors just, you know, what we think that war means today. What are the implications? What are the legacies for World War II in the present day? So that's our mission statement. Anybody who works at the museum, you can test me on this, should be able to rattle that off. You know, you tap them on the shoulder and they should be able to recite the mission statement. But I think it really does state who we are, what we're doing, and why we're doing it.
Well, you come to this not only as the senior historian, but as the son of a World War II veteran, who an Army veteran in the Pacific War, served at Guadalcanal campaign as a combat medic. This has to be something that you're particularly passionate about in terms of teaching and making sure this the history and the lessons here aren't really lost on today's generation of up-and-coming young men and women.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I get asked all the time, why World War II? What got you interested in this? Obviously, I mean, it's been an obsession for me. It's been my career, my writing, both inside and outside of the academy. I write for the popular magazines, but I also write, you know, books with a lot of footnotes for my fellow professors. And I get asked all the time, you know, what is that all about? My reflexive answer, Jim, and you just hit on is, well, my dad fought in World War II. But I got to say this. The place and time where I was born and grew up, the west side of Cleveland, Ohio, I was born in 1958. Everybody's father fought in World War II. I mean, I look at my friends and virtually every single one of them had that same story. And they didn't all go on to, you know, to do it for a career. I thank some professors I had at university and the university itself, the Ohio State University. You and I have just talked, and I know you're from Michigan. You're from the Detroit area, and I know that we could be enemies, but let's just agree to be friends for the moment.
No civil war today.
No civil war today. Good. You know, at the time when I was attending university, mid-70s. Ohio State and a lot of universities in America still required you to take a foreign language in order to graduate. I don't think that really is true anymore at most universities, but I looked at the languages I could take. I decided to take German. And I joke, you know, it was the one that wasn't at 8 a.m. I mean, I honestly don't remember why I decided to take German, but it was at a convenient time. I had some interest in reading books on World War II, and then I just took to the language. And so I learned it pretty fast, in other words. I gained a facility in it, we say. And that interest, native interest, because of my dad in World War II, and then linked to my ability to read books in a foreign language on this vast war, just really kind of, I don't know, it was like plugging my finger into an electric socket, and it's never really stopped since. But yeah, I think behind all that, that's my personal story, but behind all that, I and anyone who does what I do for a living and the museum where I now work, we feel we have a responsibility. We don't want history to pass away. We don't want World War II to become, you know, dusty words on a page that mean nothing to anyone. We want people to think, you know, these were young, mostly young men, but a sizable number of young women as well, who put their lives on hold, either volunteered or were drafted and sailed off to far-flung areas. My dad was born in Cleveland, Ohio. He probably said to himself at some point, what am I doing on Guadalcanal? He probably never even heard that name, that word, before he got there. I'd really be surprised if he had. And he is typical of the 16 million men and women who put on a uniform in World War II for the United States of America. The country only had about 135 million people at the time. That's about one in every eight went off and again, uniformed personnel. And you know what the other seven did? They supported the war effort abroad, usually in the factories or in the economy or little kids doing scrap drives, you name it. You know, there was some job, some war-related task for virtually everyone in the country. We think it's important that Americans nowadays not forget that time when Americans really had to work together in pursuit of a common goal. We think it's important today.
And at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, if I come down there, tell me about the buildings, the facilities, the various pavilions and theaters I'm going to get a chance to get exposed to.
Okay, you settled in?
I am, yes.
This can be a long answer or a short. I'll give you the sort of shorter version. Look, we think at the National World War II Museum, we have an experience for every visitor who comes. Whether you consider yourself a World War II expert or buff, or you barely even heard of World War II, we think, you know, we have something that is going to engage you and something that is going to stimulate you and make you want to know more about the topic. So you can see our Campaigns of Courage Pavilion, which has two gigantic exhibits, The Road to Berlin and The Road to Tokyo. Now, as you might guess, The Road to Berlin is the war in Europe, and The Road to Tokyo is that vast war we fought across, you know, 64 million square miles of the Pacific Ocean against Japan. We tell you the big story. We have maps. We have arrows pointing toward one another in the best tradition of military maps. But you know something else we have? We always bring that big story down to the personal level. Individual soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, medics, nurses, home front workers, you name it. We have what we call personal story panels, which tell you their story. We also have over 10,000 interviews with veterans of the war. It's certainly the largest veterans interview archive anywhere, and we're very, very proud of it. We've been doing it for decades, hunting down, tracking down veterans wherever they live and getting their story. So there's a surprising number of people who come to our museum, and I see leaving the museum in tears. And often it's because of some extremely poignant personal story that they just heard that maybe reminded them of their own dad or grandfather or uncle or someone they knew, or simply moved them on a human level. So it's the big story of the war, a lot of fighting in our museum. You can get all the fighting that you wish, but it's always brought down to the level of the individual. I think that's what we're proudest of.
You said a lot of people visit. Last year in 2019, before, you know, COVID happened here in 2020, what type of numbers of visitors do you have? Where do they come from? How long do they stay?
Sure. I've been here since 2016, so by no means am I the expert, the first expert on this topic. I've only been here 4 years now. But when I came, we used to say a low 740,000 visitors per year, and that we were coming up to, I think last year we came close or maybe just topped, I'd have to look, 800,000 visitors a year. So, I mean, if you do the math on that, that's a couple thousand and some change visitors a day. Now, you know, that's not in the ballpark of some of the larger museums in Washington, D.C., because New Orleans is not Washington, D.C. People are in Washington for all sorts of reasons, and then they go see the great museums of the country. New Orleans is a little bit more difficult to get to. You know, it's down here on the Gulf of Mexico. So we are extremely proud of that number. We drive a large number of hotel rooms every year in the city of New Orleans. This is a city that lives and dies by tourism, of course, and we really help it along because a lot of people do come for the museum. Now, you asked an interesting question about how long do they stay. You know, I used to say, boy, when people would ask me, I'd say block out a day because this is a big museum. I mentioned the Road to Berlin, Road to Tokyo. We have the Arsenal of Democracy, which is America on the home front. We have the Freedom Pavilion, the Boeing Center, which has our mega artifacts. You know, we have a B-17, gigantic four-engine bomber, Jim, that's dangling from the ceiling here at the museum. We have all kinds of aircraft, and they're not on the ground. They're not static display as much as they are in the air, you know, seemingly coming at you from all directions. So it definitely takes more than a day, and that's why you know, the museum across the street is now the Higgins Hotel, which, you know, where you're encouraged to stay and then come to the museum. And so spend a couple of days here, because I think it's going to take you at least a couple of days. But look, we have people who just say, hey, I have an hour. And I said, well, let me show you the B-17. And, you know, we can stand there for an hour. And
you'll be awed. Right. You know, you'll be awed. And you say, think about hundreds of these flying at the same time.
Well, you know, let's not say hundreds. Think about thousands of them flying at the same time. Because by 1943-44, we were carrying out 1,000 plane raids against German cities. You're talking about not only a sight that would block out the sun, but a roaring drone that would just get into your bones. I mean, that's a lot of piston-driven engines moving around the air at once.
I want to jump off. You mentioned the Higgins Hotel, and I'm going to use that for you to remind our veteran radio listeners, Dr. Robert Satino, who was
Satino.
Who was Andrew Higgins, and what role did he play?
That's a good question. So here's the question, Jim, that I get asked the most often. And that is, why is the National World War II Museum in New Orleans? When people here in America, whether it's fair or not, you think of a national museum and you think of Washington, D.C., right? I mean, you know, I know that, you know that, we all know that. But this national museum is located in New Orleans. Now, I've already mentioned to you the two professors, Stephen Ambrose and Nick Mueller. They were professors at the University of New Orleans. Stephen Ambrose famously wrote Band of Brothers, you know, about that, about the airborne forces, airborne U.S. forces fighting in Europe. And he had been very successful in interviewing veterans, and nobody brings home that, nobody brings home that immediate experience of combat like Stephen Ambrose. But, you know, there's another reason, and here's why they thought that we needed to have a museum. It's not just because they were interested in World War II. During World War II, New Orleans was home to a shipbuilding firm that made more than half of all the craft that made up the U.S. Navy in World War II, and it was Higgins Shipbuilding, named for Andrew Higgins, actually, down here in the South. Not surprised to hear his name, Andrew Jackson Higgins. Higgins owned this shipbuilding company that made a particularly important craft. It's kind of ungainly, relatively shallow draft, flat bottom, has a door in front, and it's called the LCVP, the Landing Craft Vehicle Personnel. The craft rolls to sails to the beach. The ramp comes down. The men on the craft charge off into battle. It's a way to deposit men and equipment onto a beach as rapidly as possible. And of course, you're being fired at. You want it to happen as rapidly as possible. Now, that LCVP, Landing Craft Vehicle Personnel, became more colloquially known, better known as the Higgins boat.
That's right. That's where we were getting to.
And that's where we're getting to. I'm sorry if I took too long. I did shorten that.
No. No, it's because sometimes people hear these little snippets and they don't know the history behind it or where it came from. And here it ties into why the museum's in New Orleans, and it's an interesting piece of history. And New Orleans isn't an easy place to be. The museum's had a couple of near bankruptcies, and then, you know, if you get out of that, we're going to throw in Hurricane Katrina, and if you get out of that, we're going to throw in some COVID-19 pandemic shutdowns, which has impacted every museum in the country. Tell us how it's impacted the World War II Museum.
Well, it certainly has impacted us. Look, I just got here in 2016. So it was smooth sailing here at the museum until COVID. We had to close down in March. We're open now, but we're operating about a quarter to a half capacity. If we usually get 2,000 people, you know, we're getting a few hundred people, and we're building that. We're building our visitorship back. But I'll tell you, Jim, there were plenty of employees here. We're here in 2005 when Katrina hit. And so in 15 years at the museum, they've had a near apocalyptic flood and now a plague. I mean, it's kind of biblical if you stop to think about the troubles that New Orleans has had with Katrina and now COVID.
Look out for the locusts next year.
And you know what's next, honest. You know, you could even say look out for the locusts. But, well, what happened is we did what I think a lot of museums tried to do. And I would say, you know, without any special pleading here, that I think we did it better than some because we really were committed to it. We went digital. No, if you couldn't come to the museum because of COVID, we were closed. The sort of city was closed. The state was closed. Not much tourism. So if you couldn't come because of COVID, we could come to you. We did webinars. So that's, you know, a live broadcast of some sort that we would then simulcast on our Facebook page. We've done them virtually every day that we've been out. And I can tell you, as having been behind a few of them and worked on some of the others, and I can tell you the kind of pace of this has really been day, night, 24/7 to make sure that people know that at the lunch hour, 11 a.m. or, you know, roughly the middle of the day, they can tune in, not to a radio station, but to the National World War II Museum and get their fill of World War II content. We've interviewed authors. We've had roundtables discussing the anniversary of this or that battle. We have someone here in the Media and Education Center. Abby Edens is her name, who's an expert chef and baker, and has been baking recipes that you would bake if you had a ration card at the time. You know, you only had so much of this and so much of that. We've had curators take you through the collection. We've looked at our aircraft. We've had, you know, lessons in how to draw combat aircraft. We've done just about everything we could think of and then some. And I'm pretty proud of the result. I think a lot of people have come to know the museum. Even some of our best friends have come to know it in a new way as we've just kind of really laid on this digital content. And, you know, even when we go back, I think we've learned a lot of lessons about how to bring our museum to the people, as it were, at the same time that we want to invite everyone, once conditions reestablish themselves, to come down here in New Orleans, view a beautiful city, and see a great museum.
So let's remind folks, Bob, how they can find your digital content. Give us the website, the Facebook. How do we find the content?
Sure. So I would, if you know, the simplest thing in the world is to go to our website. And our website is, if you don't mind, I always laugh when people do this, but it's National WW2, number two, not II, but number two, museum, all one word, National WW2museum.org. We're not a, you know, we're not an EDU, we're not a university, we're an organization. So we're National World War II Museum.org, and that two is the number two. And on our website, you'll be taken through all our exhibits, permanent exhibits, traveling exhibits, temporary exhibits. We had one going just at the time COVID hit called the Ghost Army, about the sort of diversionary efforts that were made to fool the Germans about where we were landing in Europe in 1944.
Right.
You know, Jim, yeah. Inflatable tanks and dummy radio messages. We have a podcast that you can find out and access from there on the Truman administration. You know, President Roosevelt was the great wartime president. He died in April and the war wasn't over. The war was not over in Europe until May, and it wasn't over in Japan until September. And sometimes, you know, I think Harry Truman doesn't really get his due. And we've made sure with this podcast we put on called To the Best of My Ability, about the Truman administration at the end of the war, 75th anniversary, that people are going to remember him. You know, besides, I had the Institute for the Study of War and Democracy. We try to be the scholarly wing, in a sense, of the museum higher education outreach. But we also have a media and education center that does K-12, and there are electronic wizards, and there's some smart people working over there. And so I was in a few of those Harry Truman episodes, some other members of the Institute. The media center really did a fantastic job in putting together our own podcast. So that's, Jim, where I would start, looking at our website. And then from there, you can be directed to just about any place you want to go. Now, the second place is to go to Facebook, and try not to make a... Mark Zuckerberg doesn't need for me to do an advertisement for him on the air, but go to Facebook and then just look up National World War II Museum and get to our Facebook page and you'll see our feed. And we're putting stuff out all day, every day, both written content and also digital media, audio and video. And we have just about everything you could want.
No, it's a fantastic resource of information, and we encourage people to go look at the website, spend some time there, get some education there. And if you're a teacher or you're homeschooling, there's a pretty significant distance learning programs that you have up, as you mentioned, through your media center folks. And you've trained a lot of students and a lot of teachers about how to teach or learn about World War II and what its meaning is today.
You know, I'm proud of a lot of things about working here at the National World War II Museum, but the outreach we do to the educational the community is really special. We have a teacher training seminar every summer. This year it's going to be a remote, but usually we would invite 30 high school professors, excuse me, I'm a professor myself, 30 high school teachers to the National World War II Museum. There they would hear experts lecturing on various content areas of World War II, sharing teaching methods of how to get complicated wartime material across to your students at various levels. Then we would send those 30 home, and they would each run their own seminar for 30 of their own colleagues. And so, you know, we're having an outreach or an impact of almost 1,000 teachers a year, 900 to be precise, but almost 1,000 teachers a year. That cohort then would regather at the end of a year and actually go off to one of the sites, maybe to Pearl Harbor or to Normandy to see things on site. Along with that, we have put out high school curricula, both for the Road to Berlin, Road to Tokyo, and now also for Liberation for the End of the War, the Arsenal of Democracy. So we've done some good work. And again, I can't compliment my colleagues in the Media and Education Center enough. Gemma Birnbaum is the AVP, the Associate Vice President over there. She's my equivalent in the Media and Education Center, and she's done some stellar work over there.
Well, we certainly appreciate the time that you've given us today, Dr. Robert Satino, to talk about the National World War II Museum in New Orleans.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.